So rasch wie möglich. That's the tempo marking at the beginning of Robert Schumann's Piano Sonata No. 2 in G minor. In English, as fast as possible. For an accomplished pianist, playing as fast as possible should be no trouble. Or so you'd think.
And then, near the end of the first movement, it comes a section that says, faster. And then in the last two pages, he says, still faster. So automatically, you're dealing with the realm of the impossible.
That's Mark Waite. He's a pianist and dean of Blair School of Music at Vanderbilt University. He first played the sonata in 1968. And now, over 50 years later, has played it more than any other piece of music. I'm Kara McLeland, in for Colleen Phelps, and this is Keeping Score. On this episode, I'll talk to Waite about how he fell in love with the peculiarities of Robert Schumann, and why playing this sonata is kind of like riding a big roller coaster. Waite says he is drawn to Schumann's frenetic energy, the same energy that spills onto the page at the opening of this sonata.
He was impulsive, very impulsive. He was manic much of his life. He clearly had strains of mental illness, which manifested itself in a fascinating way, in his composition life at least. Unlike any other composer I can think of, he wrote in bunches. His first 23 pieces are all for solo piano. It's as if he would have this fever in his brain and he just had to exorcise it by writing all of the music he could for a particular medium.
Schumann spent 12 years between 1828 and 1840, devoting himself almost entirely to solo piano music. And he worked on Sonata No. 2 for nearly that entire time. It took him 8 years to complete it from start to finish. A lot can happen in 8 years. And you can almost trace the trials and the joys of this decade of Schumann's life in the contours of this sonata. Take the energetic first movement. When Schumann started writing it in 1830, he was barely an adult, 20 years old, at the beginning of his career. Mark Waite was also 20 the first time he played this sonata, and he says he didn't have much trouble relating to Schumann's youthful energy.
I have never especially found it difficult to be manic. It's a natural state for me, in a way. And when you're 20, you know, I mean, everything is on the extreme. Everything is extreme. So it was probably a perfect piece to learn at age of 20. A little more difficult, perhaps, to play at this age now, but it's just a wonderful work. He starts off with a big G minor chord, and then the left hand using the same notes of that chord. It's almost like vibrations emanating from that chord. It starts this way. And the left hand enters. So forth.
I want to ask specifically about those tempo markings. Do you go as fast as possible, but with a little bit of gas left to?
Yeah, you definitely have to keep some gas in reserve for what's coming. And so I suppose one could play it as fast as possible, but you'd be in real trouble later on twice when it gets still faster. It's one of those things. I think that what he's trying to convey is it should feel as fast as possible. It should feel to the audience as if suddenly they're being taken by the nape of the neck very, very quickly over some very exciting terrain. You have to keep something in reserve on that.
After Schumann grabs you by the neck, musically speaking, Waite says he has another trick up his sleeve.
So the whole first movement is kind of turbulent that way, except for the second theme, which is in B flat, and that sounds like this. even that is has kind of a puzzle in it, because all of those melodic notes, this, the audience can't tell it, but those are all on offbeats. And the pianist knows it, but the audience isn't likely to. So if I counted the beats of the 1, 2, 1, 2, it's 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, and so forth. So there's the pianist playing it, there's always a feeling of being a little out of kilter, off kilter. Audience isn't going to know that. It's almost, I suppose, maybe it's a little bit like an inside musical joke. But in any case, Schumann is full of things like that in most of his works.
A few big things happen to Schumann after he starts writing this sonata. In 1832, he injures his hand, partially paralyzing some of his fingers, which totally derails his plans to become a world-class concert pianist. Now, there are a few theories as to how this happened. In one version of the story, Schumann fashions this finger-strengthening contraption out of a cigar box that bends back one finger and keeps it in place, while allowing Schumann to essentially give his weaker fingers a workout, and inadvertently injuring them. But some think that Schumann was suffering from syphilis at this time, which in the 19th century would have been treated with mercury, which is, of course, highly toxic. And some of the possible symptoms of mercury poisoning? Numbness and tingling of the hands, muscle weakness, paralysis. Regardless of the cause, this time period was full of turmoil, not unlike what listeners hear in the sonata's first movement. But by 1835, Schumann began falling in love with Clara Wieck, who was poised to become one of the greatest pianists of the Romantic era. Coming up after the break, Mark Waite explains why Robert and Clara's courtship was anything but smooth sailing.
When you want to listen to classical music but aren't near a radio, 91 Classical is still your source for great performances from Middle Tennessee and around the world. Stream music on our website while you work. Tune in via the Nashville Public Radio app on your smartphone, or tell your smart speaker you'd like to hear 91 Classical.
Welcome back to Keeping Score. The year is 1835. And Robert Schumann is smitten.
Schumann seemed to be always in a state of being in love, passionately in love, and always with Clara, who was a number of years younger than he. Her father, Friedrich Wieck, W-I-E-C-K, was a famous teacher and pianist himself. And actually, old Friedrich Wieck forbade Clara to see Schumann for a while. So theirs was a kind of a forbidden romance until old Friedrich finally caved in, and Schumann and Clara were married.
And it took a lot for Friedrich Wieck to cave. I'm talking years of legal proceedings, Wieck's outrageous demands, threats of violence, and a slander lawsuit that Robert Schumann filed and won against his future father-in-law. And all that time, Robert and Clara had to limit their interactions to clandestine meetings and secret love notes. Waite says this longing can be felt in the sonata's second movement.
For me, the second movement is really the heart and soul, the center of gravity, use whatever metaphor you want, for this piece. And it's a love song to his wife, Clara. And the melody is simple, achingly yearning. By the way, there's another little musical joke. I said that there is a this piece is in 6/8, six beats to the measure. like this. But the very first thing that happens in the movement is a rest. In other words, it's a silence. Now, the audience won't know that, but the pianist feels it. So the piece starts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The great pianist Leon Fleischer had a great term for that. He calls it an accented rest. In other words, accented silence. And that's the way this feels. And then at the very end of this movement, there is a coda, which I think is just one of the most beautiful moments in all of music, and especially in Schumann. It sounds like this. Composer would have done this. And the piece would have been over. But no, Schumann just can't quite bear to let go of it. We call this a deceptive cadence. You can see why. And then he finally does decide to let go. After that movement, the pianist almost wishes, maybe the audience too, that the whole piece could be over.
That is so lovely.
You don't want to keep going on that. How can you follow that?
Remember those musical inside jokes that Waite has been talking about? The off-kilter rhythms and accented rests that really only the pianist can feel? Since Clara would become the greatest interpreter and performer and champion of Robert's work, this is another way that they would communicate with each other. He would write in little musical winks and nods and sometimes straight up spell her name with notes on the staff. And in this way, playing the sonata movement is a tiny little window into their relationship. It's like witnessing musical flirting.
This is the greatest musical depiction of intimacy that I think I've ever known. And it's the kind of an intimacy that means one thing to you when you're 20 years old, as I was when I played that, and then deepens in richness as one ages and keeps playing this piece. You're constantly finding new meanings in it, and I think it's just one of the most rewarding things to play I can think of.
So, as Waite said, how do you follow that? Well, Schumann does it in a very Schumann-y way, by taking a hard left with a fast and furious scherzo.
A scherzo is a kind of a musical joke, and it is quite short. Scherzos tend to be that way. They tend to be quite fast and sort of witty. And in this case, it seems to be kind of mashing notes together. And true to the nature of a joke, I suppose, the very ending of the scherzo is abrupt. It's like slamming into a brick wall suddenly. Here's just the last couple of lines, the last eight measures of the scherzo. And that's it.
Wow.
It's just like slamming into a brick wall suddenly like that. And then after all of those, you know, those 16th notes, those the turbulent 16th notes that we talked about in the first movement, last movement, We come back to the 16th notes, and this time, instead of the 16th notes accompanying a melody, the 16th notes themselves are the melody, and it takes off with a tremendous rush. And I left some of those 16 notes under the piano just now, but that's how it takes off. And that's one of the challenges of this piece. I mean, after you've played it, you know you've been through quite a workout.
I can imagine. You know? I love sort of the roller coaster of that movement, just
yes.
how he fluctuates between that turbulence and that sort of reminiscent of that second movement, that lyricism.
Yes.
And
that's right.
I feel like it's a nice encapsulation of just the whole piece.
That's what nearly all of Schumann's great works do. They take you through a tremendous range of emotional states and of musical states. And he does it with terrific creativity and ingenuity. But that was part of his genius. It was also part of his madness. But this is part of what makes this sonata great, is part of what makes Schumann, to me, such a compelling musical personality and human being.
As a performer, are you drawn more to playing that sort of manic or that...
Well, I used to be.
Yeah.
I've settled down a little bit, I hope. And so in a way, returning to this, it's like a snapshot from the past. Would I undertake a work like this now? No, there are other kinds of music that attract me now. But this sonata has been a wonderful companion throughout my life, like a very old friend that you see every few years, and it's always great to see this old friend again. And one of the reasons it's great is that you haven't seen this friend in a few years. It's that kind of piece.
Keeping Score is a production of Nashville Public Radio's 91 Classical. The show is edited by Anita Bug. Carl Peterson is our engineer. In addition to Mark Waite's live in-studio performance of Schumann's Piano Sonata No. 2 in G minor, Opus 22, this episode featured his favorite recording of the work by Mitsuko Uchida. You can listen to all the episodes of Keeping Score for free anytime at podcasts.wpln.org or on your favorite podcasting app. I'm Kara McClelland. Thanks for listening to Keeping Score.